Greg Scharf, Brahmananda's brother, hadn't tried LSD, but he wanted higher consciousness, so he decided to try the chanting. Greg, I was 18. Everyone at the storefront had taken LSD. And I thought maybe I should too, because I wanted to feel like a part of the crowd. So I asked Umapati, hey Umapati, do you think I should try LSD? Because I don't know what you guys are talking about. He said no, that Swamiji said you didn't need LSD. I never did take it, so I guess it was okay. Hayagriva. Have you ever heard of LSD? It's a psychedelic drug that comes like a pill, and if you take it, you can get religious ecstasies. Do you think this can help my spiritual life? Prabhupada. You don't need to take anything for your spiritual life. Your spiritual life is already here. Had anyone else said such a thing, Hayagriva would never have agreed with him. But because Swamiji seemed, quote, so absolutely positive, end quote, therefore, quote, there was no question of not agreeing, end quote. Satsarupa. I knew Swamiji was in a state of exalted consciousness, and I was hoping that somehow he could teach the process to me. In the privacy of his room, I asked him, is there a spiritual advancement that you can make from which you don't fall back? By his answer, yes, I was convinced that my own attempts to be spiritual on LSD, only to fall down later, could be replaced by a total spiritual life such as Swamiji had. I could see he was convinced, and I was convinced. Greg, LSD was like the spiritual drug at the time, and Swamiji was the only one who dared to speak out against it, saying it was nonsense. I think that this was the first battle he had to conquer in trying to promote his movement on the Lower East Side. Even those who came regularly to the storefront thought that LSD was good. Probably the most famous experiments with LSD in those days were by Timothy Leary and Richard Alpert, Harvard psychology instructors who studied the effects of the drug, published their findings in professional journals, and advocated the use of LSD for self-realization and fulfillment. After being fired from Harvard, Timothy Leary went on to become a national priest of LSD and for some time ran an LSD commune in Millbrook, New York. When the members of the Millbrook commune heard about the Swami on the Lower East Side, who led his followers in a chant that got you high, they began visiting the storefront. One night, a group of about 10 hippies from Millbrook came to Swamiji's kirtan. They all chanted, not so much in worship of Krishna as to see what kind of high the chanting could produce. And after the lecture, a Millbrook leader asked about drugs. Prabhupada replied that drugs were not necessary for spiritual life, that they could not produce spiritual consciousness, and that all drug-induced religious visions were simply hallucinations. To realize God was not so easy or cheap that one could do it just by taking a pill or smoking. Chanting Hare Krishna, he explained, was a purifying process to uncover one's pure consciousness. Taking drugs would increase the covering and bar one from self-realization. But have you ever taken LSD? The question now became challenge. No, Prabhupada replied, I have never taken any of these things, and not even cigarettes or tea. If you haven't taken it, then how can you say what it is? The Millbrookers looked around, smiling. Two or three even burst out with laughter, and they snapped their fingers, thinking the Swamiji had been checkmated. I have not taken, Prabhupada replied regally from his dais, but my disciples have taken all these things. Marijuana, LSD, many times, and they have given them all up. You can hear from them. Hayagriva, you can speak. And Hayagriva sat up a little and spoke out in his stentorian best. Well, no matter how high you go on LSD, you eventually reach a peak, and then you have to come back down. Just like traveling into outer space in a rocket ship, he gave one of Swamiji's familiar examples. Your spacecraft can travel very far away from the Earth for thousands of miles, day after day, but it cannot simply go on traveling and traveling. Eventually, it must land. On LSD, we experience going up, but we always have to come down again. That's not spiritual consciousness. When you actually attain spiritual or Krishna consciousness, you stay high because you go to Krishna. You don't have to come down. You can stay high forever. Prabhupada was sitting in his back room with Hayagriva and Umapati and other disciples. The evening meeting had just ended and the visitors from Millbrook had gone. Krishna consciousness is so nice, Swamiji, Umapati spoke up. You just get higher and higher and you don't come down. Prabhupada smiled. Yes, that's right. No more coming down, Umapati said, laughing, and the others also began to laugh. Some clapped their hands, repeating, no more coming down. The conversation inspired Hayagriva and Umapati to produce a new handbill. This is the handbill. In capital letters it says, stay high forever, exclamation point. And under that, no more coming down. Practice Krishna consciousness. Expand your consciousness by practicing the, and then it's all laid out. In capital letters, transcendental sound vibration. And then underneath that, in capital letters, Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Ram, Hare Ram, Ram Ram, Hare Hare. The leaflet went on to extol Krishna consciousness over any other high. It included phrases like, end all bring downs, and turn on, and it spoke against employing artificially induced methods of self-realization and expanded consciousness. Someone objected to the flyers playing too much off the hippie mentality, but Prabhupada said it was all right. And Grig, when these people on the Lower East Side came and talked to Swamiji, who was so patient with them, he was speaking on a philosophy which they had never heard before. When someone takes LSD, they're really into themselves, and they don't hear properly when someone talks to them. So Swamiji would make particular points, and they wouldn't understand him. So he would have to make the same point again. He was very patient with these people, but he would not give in to their claim that LSD was a bona fide spiritual aid to self-realization. Let's stop there. The devotees printed up a lot of these Stay High Forever pamphlets. They were sort of this size, you know, book size, like this book. About like this, and they printed up quite a few of them. And when I saw them, I also thought it was kind of pandering to the hippies a little bit, because it was kind of in their language, stay high forever, and I thought that you should be more like a monk or, you know, more conservative. So I thought it was a little outlandish. That was my feeling when I saw these stay high forever things. But anyway, I guess Prabhupada liked them. And it was kind of the beginning of his way of dealing with what was around at the time and who was there and Yukta Vairagya and all that. So I think it was pretty successful, actually. Okay. So we're reading from Srimad Bhagavatam, Prabhupada's translations and purports. Third canto, seventh chapter, text number 20, is it? 19. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Narayanam namaskrityam naram chaivam narottamam devim sarasvatim vyasam datho jayamudirayat nastaprayeshu avadreshu nityam bhagavata sevaya bhagavati dama shloke bhakti bhavati naishtiki yat sevaya bhagavataha kuta stasya madhudvisha rati raso bhavet tivraham padayor yasanardanaham yatsevaya bhagavata yatsevaya bhagavata kutastasya madhudvishaha kutastasya madhudvishaha vatiraso bhavet tivraham Tiraso bhavet tivra Padayor vasanadanaha Parayor Vyasanardhanaha Yatsevaya Bhagavata. Yat, to whom? Sevaya, by service. Bhagavata, of the personality of Godhead. Kutastasya, of the unchangeable. Madhu Dvishaha, the enemy of the Madhu Asura. The enemy of the Madhu Asura. Rati Rasaha, attachment in different relationships. Bhave develops. Tivra, highly ecstatic. Padayo, of the feet. Vyasana, distresses. Ardhanaha, vanquishing. Translation by Srila Prabhupada. By serving the feet of the spiritual master, one is enabled to develop transcendental ecstasy in the service of the personality of Godhead, who is the unchangeable enemy of the Madhu demon, and whose service vanquishes one's material distresses responsibly. By serving the feet of the spiritual master, one is enabled to develop transcendental ecstasy in the service of the personality of Godhead, who is the unchangeable enemy of the Madhu demon, and whose service vanquishes one's material distresses. Purport by Srila Prabhupada. The association of a bona fide spiritual master like the sage Maitreya can be of absolute help in achieving transcendental attachment for the direct service of the Lord. The Lord is the enemy of the Madhu demon, or in other words, he is the enemy of the sufferings of his pure devotee. The word Rati Rasaha is significant in this verse. Service to the Lord is rendered in different transcendental mellows, relationships, neutral, active, friendly, parental, and nuptial. A living entity in the liberated position of transcendental service to the Lord becomes attracted to one of the above-mentioned mellows. And when one is engaged in transcendental loving service to the Lord, one's service attachment in the material world is automatically vanquished. As stated in the Bhagavad Gita 2.59, Vastavarjam asopyasya param drishtam nivartate. Yatsevaya Bhagavata Kutastasya madhu dishaha rati raso bhavet tivra padayor yasanardhanaha. By serving the feet of the spiritual master, one is enabled to develop transcendental ecstasy in the service of the personality of Godhead, who is the unchangeable enemy of the Madhu demon, and whose service vanquishes one's material distresses. Can someone bring me that Bhagavad Gita? I think I see it there. Yeah. By serving the feet of the spiritual master, one is enabled to develop transcendental ecstasy in the service of the personality of Godhead, who is the unchangeable enemy of the Madhu demon, and whose service vanquishes one's material distresses. Now, this verse indicates that one of the reasons that one engages in devotional service is relief from distress. And people who want relief from distress are one of the four kinds of people described in the Bhagavad Gita who come to Krishna. Janaksukritin Arjuna. Artvajigyasar Artvati Yanichabharat Harshavam. Many people are seeking relief from distress. They're seeking happiness. They are seeking peacefulness. One of the side effects of spiritual life or Krishna consciousness or being on the path of spiritual life or Krishna consciousness is relief from distress. This isn't the ultimate goal. The ultimate goal is to attain perfection at the lotus feet of Krishna. Or as it is stated here, a living entity in the liberated position of transcendental service to the Lord becomes attracted to one of the above-mentioned mellows. The idea is that before one can understand what the Siddha Sarup or the Siddha Pranali is, one has to come to the liberated platform of understanding one is at the lotus feet of Krishna or a loving servant of the Lord. So this is mentioned in the purport to the 35th verse of the 4th chapter of Bhagavad Gita, wherein Prabhupada states at the end of the purport, liberation means to be situated in one's constitutional position as an eternal servitor of Krishna. And then parentheses, Krishna consciousness. So it's stated also in the Chaitanya Chaitamrita that all living entities are constitutionally part and parcel of Krishna, but that is their position. And there's nothing beyond that. So this is what a transcendentalist aspires for, to attain that position of eternal servitorship of Krishna. And in that position, one can then understand, one is fixed and pure in consciousness, how one relates to Krishna or what particular rasa one likes, the conjugal, the parental, the friendly, the neutral, the servitor rasa that I mentioned here. So relief from distress is a side effect. It's not the main goal, but it happens. And devotees are naturally very happy and peaceful, and they have all good qualities. But they strive for something that is different. They strive for satisfaction by being eternal servitors of Krishna. By serving the feet of the spiritual master, the verse says, one is enabled to develop transcendental ecstasy. This is a conversation, of course, between Vidura and Maitreya. And both are very exalted devotees. Maitreya is known for his spiritual acumen. And Vidura was said to be very learned, very wise, very fortunate, and the foremost of all the learned men of his time. That was the benediction that he was given by Vyasadeva, his father. And according to other stories or other histories, I think in the Puranas, this is mentioned by Prabhupada, that Vidura was formerly Yamaraj. There was a king, Manduka Muni, sometimes he's known as Madhyava Muni, Madhavya Muni. This Muni was captured accidentally, according to the story, as a thief. And his punishment was that he would be pierced by a lance. And when he went to Yamaraj, he was told that he had to suffer this kind of death because in his childhood, he had pierced an insect with a lance. So he thought this was very unfair of Yamaraj. So he cursed Yamaraj that he would have to take birth in the material world. But actually, Yamaraj, who was a great devotee of the Lord, took this not as a curse, but as a great blessing, because he was very tired of having to sit and judge people and mete out various punishments and rewards. So he thought this was a great blessing that he could come to the material world, and therefore he incarnated as Vidura, according to that Puranic account. And he was very happy. He became the prime minister of Dhritarashtra, of Hastinapur, and was known for being very, very wise. Of course, he was the son of Vyasadeva, so he had that lineage. But he was considered very learned and very wise of the three brothers, Dhritarashtra, Pandu, and Vidura. Vidura was the one who was, remember the story, born of the maidservant of Ambika. The maidservant, unlike Ambika and Avalika, who were very afraid of Vyas because he had a very fearful aspect, instead of closing the eyes, which Ambika did, or Avalika, was very terrified. And poor Pandu, which means the pale one, the maidservant of Ambika, served the sage very nicely and wasn't worried about his ferocious-looking aspect. And therefore, Vidura, her offspring, was considered to be a very, because of that, because of the attitude of his mother, very wise, very learned, and extremely intelligent. So he did become the prime minister, and he was always a counselor to Dhritarashtra, always giving him good counsel. Of course, Dhritarashtra was too immersed in his own ways, which were to promote his own son, who was a bit of a rascal, to say the least, to be the emperor. And of course, Dhritarashtra, this is a bit of a side story, but he was said to be very powerful and had the strength of 10,000 elephants. That was the benediction given him, said in the Mahabharata. So this is part of the story. At the end of the war, when the Pandavas came to get his blessings after they had killed all his 100 sons, including Duryodhana, Dhritarashtra sought to embrace Bhima. Bhima, of course, was the archenemy of Duryodhana. He was the one who killed him in the mace match. And I don't know if he thought that he wanted to do this at the beginning, but Krishna knew that when he would embrace him, because he was very, very strong, 10,000 elephants is not exactly a weakling, he, instead of bringing Bhima before him to accept the embrace, he brought the iron statue of Bhima, the one that Duryodhana had practiced smashing with his mace for years and years on end. He was pretty fired up. So Krishna put this iron form of Bhima before Dhritarashtra. When he embraced him, because he was so powerful, he literally crushed this iron visage, iron statue into dust, which would have meant that he would have done the same thing to Bhima had Krishna not intervened and put the iron statue in its place. Anyway, a little bit of Mahabharatisms. So Vidura was very prominent, and he was considered very learned. Because he was very learned, he also took to the instruction of Maitreya very readily. He considered the instructions of Maitreya to be not ordinary teachings, but very valuable instructions. And therefore, this conversation is immortalized in the pages of the Bhagavatam, this conversation between two great sages. And of course, Shravanam, Kirtanam, Smaranam, Vishnu. The personification of hearing was Maharaj Bhrigat, and the personification of speaking or Kirtan was Shukadeva Goswami. Both were very learned, but it's the mark of all great souls, including Krishna and Lord Chaitanya themselves, to have a spiritual master, to take their words as being very important and to live by them. So this was one of the things that Vidura did. And he's now saying that by serving, he's coming to the realization about Vidura, is that by serving the feet of the spiritual master, one is enabled to develop transcendental ecstasy. And the word Madhu is used here, or Madhubhisha, one of Prabhupada's disciples is named that, Madhubhisha, because Krishna is the slayer of the Madhu demon. Now, not too much is known about this Madhu demon. It's kind of an esoteric thing, but the name Madhusudan is used quite a lot in the Bhagavad Gita. So the name is important, and it was, I think one devotee asked Prabhupada in a letter, who is this Madhu demon? And he was asked, and apparently it was some demon who at the beginning of creation tried to swallow up Lord Brahma, and Lord Krishna intervened and killed him. So he was a very, very powerful demon who lived at the beginning of time. And time and again, Krishna is referred to as Madhusudan, or the killer of the Madhu demon. Now, it's mentioned here that the Lord is the enemy of the Madhu demon, or in other words, he is the enemy of the sufferings of his pure devotees. In one lecture, Prabhupada was talking about this Madhu demon. I think he was lecturing on Bhagavad Gita early on. It was around about 1966. And why was Arjuna using this word Madhu? Well, he was objecting to having to follow Krishna's instructions to fight this war because he realized that his own martial arts teacher, Dronacharya, was on the opposite side. And this became a bit of a complexity for him, a bit of a bewilderment. And in the Mahabharata, and Prabhupada narrates this too, he fired an arrow at his martial arts teacher at the outset, or when they knew there was going to be war. I don't know if it was on the battlefield or before, and this arrow landed at his feet. It was a kind of a salute, a kind of a Kshatriya obeisances. So, but this was his teacher. It was his martial arts teacher. So he addresses Krishna as Madhusudan. In other words, he was saying, you killed your enemies. You killed a demon. But you didn't kill your guru. And now you're asking me to kill my guru. So in this way, he was very subtly charging Krishna with this equivocal instruction. Why are you asking me to take arms against my guru? You killed, but you didn't kill your guru. You killed the enemy. You killed the demonic personalities. So in this way, the word Madhusudana was used in different ways throughout the Bhagavad Gita as an address to Krishna by Arjuna for different reasons. He had his reasons for it. And then in other places, the Madhu demon is likened to our material mentality, that it's kind of symbolic that he's addressing Krishna as Madhusudana. And the demon is the demon of the mind, and Prabhupada refers to this too, that the Madhu demon is a representative symbolically of the demon within our mind. So in another sense, Krishna is saying to Arjuna is certainly saying to Krishna, that you're the killer of the Madhu demon. Now this demon of doubt, this demon of material enjoyment, this demon of distress, the demon of my mind has become very prominent. I'm bewildered by it. I don't know what to do. So I'm asking you to please slay this demon, because this demon is even more powerful than the big demon, than the demon Madhu, who you killed. Very big, more powerful than the demons that we encounter on the outside. It's the demon within, the devil in the detail, or whatever we want to call it. But it's very powerful, the mind. And as we read in the Bhagavad Gita, the mind is our best friend or our worst enemy. And if it's our worst enemy, then it must be worse than any demon that we might encounter. So, indirectly, Arjuna is asking Krishna to slay the demon of his mind, to put him on the right track, to show him how to overcome the demon of the mind. Very, very difficult. One of the things in this verse that's significant also is the fact that one can serve the feet of the spiritual master and thereby be enabled to come to the level of transcendental ecstasy. It's very popular to not want to accept anyone as perfect, even if that person might be a leader or a teacher or an authority on any subject. The tendency, especially today, is not to accept him or her fully, partially, because after all, everyone is imperfect according to our way of thinking. So we don't have experience of perfect people. There was an incident, I don't know if I talked about this before, but when Chaitanya Mahaprabhu was gaining prominence in Navadvip, the Nawab was beginning to wonder who he was. And kind of like the Romans, when Jesus Christ was living, they knew there was something special about him, and this Nawab knew there was something special about him. So he didn't really want it, this particular one, Hussein Shah, didn't want to take arms against him, or didn't really want to interfere, because he thought there was something very extraordinary or special. He saw large numbers of people following Chaitanya Mahaprabhu around. And being a king, who always travels in a retinue, always with the ministers and the servants around wherever he went, there was always a big herd of followers and servants and ministers. But Chaitanya Mahaprabhu had thousands and thousands of people. So he asked Sanatana Goswami, who was one of his prime ministers, who is this man, this Hindu, who's always walking around with thousands of people following him? I can't understand it. Sanatana Goswami said, well, you shouldn't have to ask me. This is actually a great Muslim saint. And he named, it's kind of hard to hear on the tape what the name of the saint was, but he said, he's actually so-and-so. In other words, he's an incarnation of this famous, great Mohammedan peer, or whatever they call him. There's a word for him. Mullahs are highly elevated saints in the Muslim faith. So he convinced him, he convinced the Nawab that this man is, he's really a saint, and he is an incarnation of this. He's just, and you're very fortunate because he's in your own kingdom. This is auspicious for you. This is good luck and good fortune for you. So he was convinced, and he didn't interfere. And of course today his grave is still worshipped by Hindus in the Navadvip area. In Mayapur. That access to Chaitanya Mahaprabhu and Jesus Christ, all the other great personalities, the ability to have access to spiritual persons who we respect, whose spiritual acumen we think is great, who are above ours, this is one of the things that gives us relief. It gives us actually access. In fact, it's the thing that gives us access, because we see that in the human beings that are generally regarded as imperfect, we can see that there is perfection. And therefore, we're able to advance and come to understand that, yes, God exists, God can be served, we can serve Him, we can associate with others. So for this reason, association with great souls is very important. And Vidura, who was a great soul himself, thought that association with Maitreya was very, very important, extremely important for him. Not just someone to hang out with or be friends with, but that he would get purified in that association. Something like this. There's all different kinds of, many different kinds of ways of worshiping the Lord. And they offer sometimes prayers. Like when we were all young, we probably all said some kind of prayers. I know I did. And I used to just make up what God looked like. And I didn't know what God looked like, because I was taught in Sunday school to think that God isn't a person like you and I, but He's a force or an energy, that was the in way to think about God, that's really the more advanced way to understand Him. And Prabhupada talked about how Mayavadis sometimes pray. They have prayers, and according to what Prabhupada said in one lecture in Los Angeles, they say, "My dear Lord, you," because this is part of the Vedas, "you who are handless, have no ears, have no eyes, have no legs, please accept my obeisances." So Prabhupada interpreted this that it's like going up to a friend and saying, "Oh, my dear friend, you're lame, you're blind, you're deaf, you can't walk, you can't take anything." So he said, although this is a prayer that's very common, because it's mentioned indirectly, that this is actually an insult. And so he said, this is an insult to God. Although it is a prayer, it's an insult, because what they're saying indirectly is, you can't see, you can't hear, you can't walk, you can't smell, you can't taste, you can't do anything. You have no sentient qualities. So in this way, the Mayavadi philosophy was something that Prabhupada disdained a great deal. So it's 8 o'clock and I'm going to stop. Do you have any comments or questions? Bye-bye. Mm-hmm. Neutrality rasa is a rasa of knowing that God is great and that I am small. And the grass kind of has that rasa. It just sort of stands there, and then Krishna walks on it. Oh, that feels great. You know, it's kind of a certain rasa that some aspire to and achieve. But basically it's knowing that God is great and I am small. So I don't have an active kind of role like a servant or a parent or a lover. Not quite the same thing. Or a friend. So therefore it's called neutral because it doesn't have activity. It's inactive, sort of a passive role. Not a neutral role. Praying. How is it supposed that the Lord is hearing the prayer? Well, people who pray generally think that God is hearing their prayers, whatever they're saying. They have that much faith that there's God and He can hear me, even though He's deaf and He doesn't have any ears. But they have the sense that God perceives somehow the voice or what they're saying, or they may be saying it silently or maybe saying it in their mind. And the thought is that there is God and he can hear. When Chaitanya Mahaprabhu was chanting, many of the local residents in Navadvip were very inimical. But they still had sort of a belief in God. And they were thinking that if there is, they weren't sure, but a lot of them thought there might be God. And that was one of the reasons that they objected to this chanting. They thought that if there is a God, that He's going to punish us, because these people are always crying and making a lot of noise and they're disturbing people. So if there's a God, he's going to punish all of us because we live in the same village that these people are chanting in. So they also had a kind of notion about God. So people have all kinds of strange ideas in general about God and what prayer is and praying to God and that he hears. So they can be praying and insulting at the same time and not even be aware of it. That's what I think Prabhupada was trying to get across. Yeah. Yes, bye-bye. Well, theoretically, Lord Brahma creates everything, but the only thing I've read is that this demon appeared at the time of the creation and tried to kill Lord Brahma. So I don't know exactly who created him. Theoretically, it would have been Lord Brahma. Yeah. The disciple finds a person who is who he thinks, he or she, is more advanced. Now, Lord Chaitanya also accepted a spiritual master, accepted Ishwara Puri. And sometimes Ishwara Puri even asked Chaitanya Mahaprabhu to find some fault, and he was reading his book, Govinda Lamrita, to him night after night. And Lord Chaitanya wouldn't do it. And one day he did find some fault. And Ishwara Puri was a very learned scholar himself, studied the book all night long and tried to find out what was wrong, if this was true. And he went back to Lord Chaitanya and said, actually, I couldn't find anything wrong. I think it's right. So Lord Chaitanya said, I'm defeated. You're right. And of course, no one could defeat him. It was the first time he ever been defeated because he was still Nimai Pandit then, known as Nimai Pandit, and no one could defeat him, but he accepted defeat because he regarded this person as his spiritual master. So Vidura considered that Maitreya was his spiritual master, or at least a spiritual master that he should take instruction from that was more realized than he was, not considering his particular background. We could say the same thing of Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati, who took on Gurdasharya Das Babaji as his spiritual master. Now, some people would think, well, why would such a learned astronomer, mathematician, man with a perfect memory except a person who was functionally illiterate as his guru, because he thought that he had spiritual instructions to impart to him that were so superior that he could take him as his spiritual master. So in this way, Madhura saw Maitreya as being more realized than he was, even though, you know, he may have had some faults. He's a Muni, and the other, and Yamaraj was a Mahajan. Still, he considered that he could learn from him. So he accepted him as spiritual master, as someone who he could take instruction from, he could benefit by learning, just like Bhaktisiddhanta did from Gaurakishore Das Babaji, or Chaitanya did from Ishwara Puri. So it may be that in one sense one might be more advanced, but everyone takes on a spiritual master and learns. And one can't imitate such persons. That's also mentioned in the Bhagavatam. And I think between these two also there's a mention between Vidura and Maitreya of going beyond or stepping over the spiritual master, or trying to either find fault or step over. And when the gopis were singing to Krishna, they were also in that constant position. And somewhere in the 10th canto, one of those later chapters, there's a discussion about not imitating or not trying to take on the characteristics of a great personality, not examining the past or in detail the mentality. And then we have the other verse about how we can't see a Vaishnava as being an ordinary person. So one has to be careful in assessing the value of any great personality. You know, trying to find successive levels sort of thing. Jai Srila Prabhu? Oh, yes. Yeah. Yeah, very good point. And Bhadra knew about this, so he considered him to be superior. Very good. Thank you. Okay. Yeah. Me. Andrew. Prabhupada is such a great poet. He talked about dead and pale in the material world. And this Paramdrishta in the higher taste, you know, it's also very, the way he translates that, I don't know how other people translate that. You know, it's like the higher taste. Such a beautiful poetry in that verse. Of course, we think it's prasadam, but again, any food that we eat is also kind of dead and pale next to prasadam, isn't it, really? I mean, even the best restaurants in the world, their fare is dead and pale compared to prasadam, isn't it? Prasadam is very alive, and very colorful. That's a very nice verse. It shows a kind of principle that Krishna consciousness isn't sort of escapism and dryness like a lot of people think religion is. But it's the higher taste, it's Paramdrishta. And it makes everything else seem dead and pale and insignificant. Most conceptions of religion are that it's kind of dry and ethereal and not very well defined, and it's escapism, it's fanaticism. I mean, that's the way religious people are generally depicted. I'm sure that people don't know too much about us think that we're like that. We're just off in some kind of dreamland, some mystical, unreal, non-existing place, some dreamland, mystical dreamland we're in. So it's also, right, it's said in the Bhagavad Gita, Yanisha Sarva Bhutanam, that what is day for the transcendentalist is night for the materialist and vice versa. Okay, so we probably should stop here. Srila Prabhupada ki jai.